In January, the Society of Christian Ethics, the Society of Jewish Ethics, and the Society for the Study of Muslim Ethics held their joint annual conference in lovely downtown Louisville, Kentucky. During that conference, I was fortunate to be able to attend and record a panel entitled Maternal Experience as Resource and Challenge to Religious Ethics. It featured four scholars, two from the Society of Jewish Ethics and two from the Society of Christian Ethics, for an interreligious dialogue about the way maternal experience shifts our thinking about obligation, power, justice, and agency. The panel was convened by Professor Irene Oh of George Washington University and featured Dr. Mara Benjamin, Professor and Chair of Jewish Studies at Mount Holyoke College, Dr. Michal Rauscher, Assistant Professor of Jewish Studies at Rutgers, Dr. Sandra Sullivan Dunbar, Associate Professor of Theology at Loyola University Chicago, and Dr. Christy Traina, Professor and Chair of Religious Studies at Northwestern University. The participants were kind enough to let me record the session for broadcast, and now I present it to you. It's Ethics Forward from WFMP 106.5 FM Forward Radio in lovely downtown Louisville, Kentucky. My name is Avery Kohlers, and each week I bring you the insights of scholars, activists, or practitioners regarding ethical issues in our daily lives and social institutions. This week the insights come from this fantastic panel featuring members of the Societies for Christian Ethics and for Jewish Ethics. We'll be back in a moment with the panel Maternal Experience as Resource and Challenge to Religious Ethics. Don't go away! And now here's Dr. Irene Oh to introduce this session on maternal experience as resource and challenge for religious ethics.
Thank you so much for coming to this session, Maternal Experience as Resource and Challenge to Religious Ethics. Today we have four brilliant speakers. We have Mara Benjamin, Michal Rauscher, Sandra Sullivan Dunbar, and Christy Traina. The subject matter of this morning's session is maternal ethics, and each of the speakers will be addressing themes such as agency, power, duty and obligation, and justice. And so with that, we will begin.
Thank you so much for being here, and I want to really thank my colleagues for their openness to joining together in a cross-society panel, and to working together in advance to think about a few questions that we would all focus on. So I just maybe would mention what those are so that you know how we're thinking about this. We've been talking together about what are the most important challenges to our own work that arise from each other's contributions, where we see common ground, how we hope scholars working outside of the community we study will make use of our contributions to religious ethics, and how does our work provide a resource, as the title implies, to religious ethics more generally. I will be speaking about the theme of obligation. All of us today regard the responsibility toward care for and involvement with young children to reorient common, if not foundational, assumptions in modern ethics, political theory, and theology. One of those assumptions, which I'm going to make a few comments about, concerns obligation or duty. This morning I want to address three issues. One, pre-voluntary obligation. Two, obligation and agency. And three, obligation and pleasure. I will ground my remarks by considering the works of each of my colleagues in turn, each of whom addresses all of the issues, but you know, certain ones came to the fore for me. So first, pre-voluntary obligation. Pre-voluntary obligation is a given in human experience. Some such obligations are universal in the sense that all beings must be fed, sheltered from the elements, and protected from mortal danger in order to continue to exist. And Christy adds to this sort of standard list the need for intimate attachment and touch. All of us today received at least the minimum sufficient amount of each of those things. For that reason, our existence testifies to the labor and care of others, and specific others, such that regardless of whether we then offer care to others in some other form, we start from a position of indebtedness or obligation, and in Hebrew the same word chovah applies to both. Sandy and I are both preoccupied by the far-reaching implications of this fact and examine it as feminists in dialogue with our respective traditions. We each recognize the potential affinity between a feminist corrective to liberal political thought and our tradition's theological conceptions of human existence, even as those theological sources themselves require feminist correctives. Jewish sources assume a condition of pre-voluntary covenantal obligation that devolves on all Jews, as well as naming specific obligations that arise from that covenant. And I think it's fair to say that a basic position of indebtedness toward God is built into the human condition by virtue of our status as created beings, if you want to think about it more universally. Likewise, Christian theological ethics, as Sandy has argued, begins with the assumption that being a creature created by God, quote, means we are dependent on God, which makes us equal before God in dependency. Sandy's work for me has pointed to the necessity of speaking about those pre-voluntary obligations that are not what we might call universal, but which devolve upon individuals differently by virtue of our class, nationality and geography, gender, ability, language, and race. In my own work, I've argued that non-parental, paid or unpaid caregivers raise additional and often insufficiently addressed challenges for what Sarah Ruddock long ago called maternal thinking, how we can map multiplicity and not just the dyadic when we think about embodied caregiving, and what theological work is demanded by that recognition. But I think Sandy asks us to move, in her book, from the human condition of dependence, that basic state of moral debt in which we all arrive in the world, to considering the unjust structures that prevent some people's needs from being met and which erase the fact of universal need and caregiving. What she calls the enormous quantity of unmet need in the world, she reminds us, is not evenly distributed. How are we to understand our ethical duties toward those near and far when it is routine, for instance, for a parent to leave her own children across town or across the world to care for the children of an employer? These globalized chains of caregiving are ubiquitous, and yet we have still failed to bring together the asymmetries of dependence into our ethical and religious discourse. Here I agree with Sandy that we should follow thinkers like Joan Tronto in inquiring into the disparities between those who feel entitled to receive care and those whose needs for care are unrecognized by a variety of social structures, between those who are conscripted into caregiving labor and those who are not. I think we see such an investigation in Michal's study of the debates in the Knesset, and I'm sorry that it hasn't yet been published, so you just have to kind of go with this for now. But it's great, and you'll love it when it is published. The debate in the Knesset, Israeli parliament, over the circumstances permitting legal abortion, where religious lawmakers understand Haredi women, ultra-Orthodox women, to be obligated to reproduce and rear children as part of what is often called by them a demographic war for survival. These forms of injustice must be part of how we think about obligation, so it is acknowledged not only as an existential fact of the human condition, but as a tool with which social inequities are perpetuated. Second, obligation and agency. We've all read The Handmaid's Tale. So many feminists, including myself, and probably anyone who's read that, are on high alert to the fact that motherhood has for centuries been the obligation sine qua non for women. Feminist care ethics since Gilligan has walked a fine line in revaluing a moral orientation that has been marginalized while aiming to not reinscribe women's obligation to inhabit a care orientation or engage in caregiving work. Agency, I think, has become the insurance policy, as it were, that differentiates oppressive, externally directed obligation to serve others from affirming, self-directed responsiveness to needs of others. This is, of course, the legacy of none other than Kant, who understands, quote, giving oneself the moral law as involving two actors, as it were. The moral legislator, who is in fact the pure rational concept, which would later be called God by others, of every rational being, and the subject of these laws, who is a, quote, finite and fallible being whose volitions are subject to this law. I hardly expected to find Kant in the heart of ultra-Orthodox Jerusalem, but there he was, among Haredi women that Michal interviewed in Israel. Her work foregrounding the experiences of women against the backdrop of Israeli state policy, rabbinic authority, and the medical establishment challenges previous feminist scholarship that has portrayed women who accept the obligation to bear and rear children as passive or exploited executors of male directives. These women's complex negotiations with male authorities reveals that they discerned their duties by becoming their own lawgivers, as it were, sometimes at the price of making poor or dangerous choices. One research subject Michal identifies as Hila, quote, has moral authority and does not need to trust anybody else to tell her what to do during the pregnancy. In fact, trusting someone else, her doctors, her rabbis, her husband, would contradict her obligation to God and her body. Those are Michal's words. One of my questions for Michal, a question that arose from me in my own work as well, concerns the degree to which we have escaped from an implicitly Kantian model when we depend on agency to rescue us from the charge of mere submission to imposed authority. Third, obligation and pleasure. Too often, obligation or duty is constructed to require the emptying out or dissociation of us from our inclinations. The dour, solemn execution of right action becomes antithetical to the embodied lived self and its unruly desires. All of us, I think, on this panel have found resources within our material that we've studied, whether theoretical or empirical, with which to counter that construction. Sandy and Christy draw on Thomistic understandings of our natural inclinations toward the good and a moderate course in responding to those inclinations. And Michal recognizes Haredi women acting on their own desires in pregnancy and thereby going against the directives of various authorities in their lives. But I'll say that I found Christy's work on Eros and Touch in the Care of Young Children, which I read in the early stages of my own project, particularly important for outlining the legitimacy and even necessity of including pleasure in our discourse of obligation. In writing about the subjective experience of caring for one's child, I found it challenging to hold both the deep sense of burden that is intrinsic to embodied material response to the other and the egoistic dimensions of caregiving, the sensual delight and the physically and emotionally satisfying aspects of caregiving. Throughout her book, Christy articulates why the antipathy between agape and eros in some of the most influential 20th century accounts occludes a basic fact. Eros sustains parents and enables them to persist in meeting their obligations when those obligations are unpleasant, boring, or aggravating. In her words, quote, delight is not an optional luxury in parenting. Her corrective enables us to apply the same insight theologically as well, if we wish, I suppose, pushing us to aspire towards selves that take pleasure in serving God and others, and to imagine a God who delights in God's own creation. Feminism has brought and continues to bring many gifts to theology and religious ethics, and I think lifting up the redemptive quality of embodied delight is surely one of the greatest of them.
That was Mount Holyoke College Professor and Chair of Jewish Studies, Dr. Mara Benjamin, from a panel discussion on maternal experience as resource and challenge to religious ethics. Next up, we have Rutgers University Professor of Jewish Studies, Michal Rauscher.
Good morning. I echo that I'm very grateful to be on this panel, to be in conversation with these folks. I feel humbled on this panel, or intimidated, perhaps, is the better word, but happy to be here. Our scholarship and this panel starts with the premise that maternal experience has something important to add to the way that we think about and construct religious ethics. As feminist scholars, we object to the male-dominated discourse of religious ethics and demonstrate how the existing frameworks and norms do not speak to maternal experience. Furthermore, we bring the experiences of mothers and parents to the conversation because we maintain that these voices add distinct possibilities for the field of religious ethics. My co-panelists have incorporated their own maternal experiences, as well as those of others, into their scholarship. My book, which you heard about, will feature ethnographic research. I've sort of punted the maternal experience onto others. But in it, I show that ultra-Orthodox women do not turn to religious authorities for their reproductive ethics. Instead, their moral agency is based almost entirely on their maternal experience. Now, unlike my co-panelists, I haven't incorporated my own maternal experience into my scholarship. I've been too afraid of being the young female scholar in the room to talk about my children for fear that the scholar part will just fade away. But today, in the company of these brave scholars, I feel this is a safe space to show how my own maternal experience reflects some of the unique avenues for thinking about moral agency in particular. And so I'm going to use my maternal experience as a jumping off point to bring in their work. But first, a word on what I mean by agency. In Politics of Piety, Saba Mahmoud demonstrates how women in fundamentalist religious traditions can simultaneously adhere to patriarchal norms and exercise agency. For many, this is counterintuitive because they understand these norms to be externally imposed constraints on the individual. Mahmoud argues that agency is the capacity for action, even while drawing on those oftentimes subordinating norms. Liz Bukhar's work builds on Mahmoud when she finds agency within what she calls, quote, creative conformity. Bukhar proposes we see individuals as agents who are interpreting, negotiating, and applying cultural norms and religious rules in creative and often subversive ways. This approach to agency can be seen within our works, and it's the process of reinforcing and subverting cultural and religious norms that raises questions for religious ethics, which I'll return to at the end. The discussions running throughout our scholarship points to the importance of challenging binaries and rejecting the ideal or romantic, much like what's been done with agency. All three of my co-panelists discuss the extreme changes that come with caring for a newborn baby and the dichotomy between the expected and the experienced. My youngest is now 15 months old, and I can still feel the all-consumingness of having a newborn. Amidst diaper changing, soothing, feeding, and holding, I frequently discovered that I hadn't used the restroom in hours, hadn't showered in days. I left coffee cups half filled around the house, another thing that my co-panelists mentioned in their book. Doing something for her, my baby, meant not doing something for me, not exercising my agency, feeling like I was completely bound by her desires. It felt like a zero-sum game. And as Sandy's snapshots of moral complexity and caregiving relations demonstrates, I was not alone in feeling this way. Mara's reminder that there is a danger in, quote, creating a sentimental, unrealistic portrayal of parental power resonates as well. Despite the claims that I would immediately love and fiercely protect my child, those first few days, weeks, months with a newborn were not at all beautiful. I did not spend hours watching my infant sleep, when she did. If she even slept for an hour, I was spending that time trying to apply to jobs or writing grants. And when I heard her cry and my brain stopped mid-sentence, I cursed with frustration at the ways in which a baby's cry elicits physical responses in nursing mothers. Then I felt the pangs of guilt because my desire to finish whatever I was writing was stronger than my desire to soothe my child. And for a moment, I realized the power imbalance that all three of my co-panelists discuss in their work. Despite feeling beholden to my child's agency, I held a great deal of power over her. Most of the time, all I had to do was pick her up or feed her to make her stop crying, thank goodness. But conversely, I maintained the physical power to hurt my babies. And as Lori Zoloth has pointed out, when women hurt their own children, it challenges the paradigms of motherhood and ethics that surround us. Christie's exploration of the boundaries that exist in society between eroticism, abuse, and parental care reinforced notions of how mothers are supposed to behave. All of us contribute to the project of reimagining moral agency by challenging ideals of power and relationships and injecting into the conversation the messiness of real life. The messy reality brings to the fore the many ways norms surrounding us create more ethical problems than they solve. Sandy and Mara share a particular interest in the relationship between dependency and agency. Although Christian ethics and Western philosophy fail to address adequately human dependency, instead prioritizing equality between humans and the need for independence to be a requirement for autonomy and agency, ethics exists in the integration of human equality with human dependency, Sandy says. This is because all of us simultaneously experience some degree of agency and some degree of dependency. So here's vignette number two. My other daughter, who is almost 3 years old, reminds me of this every single day when I try to strap her into her car seat, a seemingly simple task. Some days she's in the mood to cooperate, or she's agreed to accept her terms of the bribe that I've provided her, either candy or listen to Frozen for the 30th time. Just as often, however, and Mara talks about this too, she makes her body limp or stiff, or she screams and wiggles around, making it all but impossible to strap her into her seat. All completely appropriate actions for a three-year-old, and all running counter to the impression that I am the sole holder of power, authority, and agency in our relationship. I am her caregiver, to be sure, and my daughter depends on me for any number of things to keep her alive. But when I'm trying to strap her into her car seat, I depend on her significantly to cooperate so that we can leave the house on time, I can get to work on time, etc. Sandy refers to, quote, degrees of agency, which I think really reflects this tension in my relationship with my stubborn three-year-old. This concept, which Mara's work reflects as well, namely that an ethical caretaking relationship is one that respects the agency of the dependent, reinforces the idea that one has agency despite one's dependency. If this is simply accepted as a human condition that we're all dependent in some ways and have agency in others, it seems to me that dependency is still a challenge to one's agency. So I wonder how my co-panelists would respond to my own finding in my work that ultra-Orthodox women in Israel expressed agency because of their dependency. Women who shared their reproductive histories with me expressed reproductive agency only during pregnancy. One reason so many were sad about giving birth was because they could no longer claim authority once the baby was on the outside. In other words, they depended on the prenate. This is Toddie Peters' word. They depend on the prenate for their agency. Does this present us with a different way of thinking about dependency and agency? Or perhaps this is connected to the last point I want to address, vulnerability and agency. Mara and Sandy remind us that one of the fundamental paradoxes of the parent-child relationship is that we aim to use our power to raise individuals with agency of their own, who don't need us as much to feed, clothe, or teach them. And while their needs change over time, and that growth is often a point of pride, Mara talks about, quote, the loss inherent in the work of empowering one's child. Each small achievement of independence, therefore, points to the death of the parent. Mara sees this feeling in the well-known Oven of Achnai story in the Talmud, where God, the ultimate teacher, watches as his children, the sages, outsmart him. Mara claims God feels defeated, an emotion I have felt recently when my six-year-old comes to intellectual conclusions faster than I expected, asks questions that I really don't know how to answer, and ultimately beats me in card games. He's shown me that my authority does not mean my ultimate knowledge. My son reminds me of my vulnerability in our relationship when he's angry with me, too. He threatens to run away, another perfectly normal developmental response that throws me into an absolute tizzy. When I'm upset with him, he expresses his desire and perhaps ability to separate himself from me. Christy's remarks have been really helpful in those moments as I feel the longing for intimacy with my child, who is so clearly trying to establish independence. In The Ethics of Vulnerability, Erin Gilson writes of the necessity of vulnerability for ethics. Quote, if we are not vulnerable, we have no need for ethics. And it's precisely because we are vulnerable, can be affected and made to feel sorrow, concern, or empathy, that we feel any compulsion to respond ethically. My vulnerability results from my child developing his own sense of agency, shifting the power dynamics in our relationship and increasing the dependency that I feel towards him. Gilson and my co-panelists would likely agree then that this vulnerability is what compels me to respond ethically, not just to my children, but to others as well. Now, the authors on this panel have made such a convincing case for the vulnerability that results from caregiving relationships, specifically maternal, but not solely at all, that I'm left to wonder whether a moral imperative could be felt absent the experience of caregiving. And as we just heard, because caregiving is no longer universally considered, there are certain people that are doing more caregiving than others. So a couple of questions I want to leave us with. One is the problem with finding agency within religious and cultural constraints is that we assume then that women are always in a position to be creative about their application of these norms should they wish to do so. If women are reinforcing norms that are ethically problematic or raise issues from a feminist perspective, then we might assume they're choosing to reinforce them. But from within this understanding of agency, we must respect a woman's ability to make a choice that we do not support. Sometimes, though, there must be situations where individuals do not have the capacity for action. And how do we, as feminists, ethically identify those situations? And the second that I want to raise is I'm so curious as to why it is frequently women's experiences that are fodder for revising the male-dominated focus of religious ethics. Presumably, all men's experiences, not to mention other marginalized bodies and individuals, are not represented in the norms and structures presented by religious authorities. And I fear that our focus on women's experiences reinforces a certain gender dichotomy between real and ideal, or between experience and authority. In Jewish terms, it's often referred to as book and life tradition. The ultimate goal, then, is how do we make experience more broadly a focus of religious ethics and ethics in general? Thank you.
And that was Rutgers University Professor Michal Rauscher on maternal experience as resource and challenge to religious ethics. Now from the same panel, here's Sandra Sullivan Dunbar from Loyola University Chicago.
My sons are now teenagers, but I'm having flashbacks listening to my colleagues talk about their experiences with their young children, and I can particularly remember lots of car seat struggles. There's a big game in my family. So I'm Sandy, and the theme that I was entering into these questions through is justice, although as I was putting down my comments, you know, power and agency and obligation, they all intersect so much. So maternal experience, as we've heard, makes very apparent the centrality of dependency in human life. And in my own work, in my book, I argue that recent Christian theologies of love, and particularly 20th century sacrificial and equal regard theologies of love, mask and marginalize human dependency and dependent care relations. In key senses, those Christian love theologies parallel liberal political theory, social contract theory, classical and neoclassical economics. And so I try to show those parallels and say that we need a political theory that understands that to be human is to be both dependent and obligated. And to paraphrase Eva Federicate, because we've received care from others to survive and to grow, we owe such care to others. We're indebted from the start. So I deeply resonated with Mara's initial chapters on obligation. So I argue that an account of Christian love that is adequate to encompass relations of dependent care must be deeply integrated with an account of justice, including distributive justice. Because dependent care relations require resources, material resources such as food and clothing and labor resources. Deprivation of those resources renders dependent care difficult or impossible. So I argue for a conception of justice in which the state provides significant material support to dependent caregivers. And just tapping into the experience, one of the experiences that drives this concern is, as a professional woman, the experience of trying to find childcare. And knowing that when I was trying to find childcare, I was paying somebody much less than I made to care for my child. And then the window into the unfortunately exploitative, but we need child care providers. But because our economy and society doesn't see dependent caregiving by parents as labor, the whole economy has shifted so that child care can only be underpaid. And that has racial implications. You know, that's been structured in ways that marginalize certain races and classes, et cetera. So in the United States, we encounter great resistance to social policies that support basic needs and caregiving. Dependency is widely seen as a moral failing, or at best an unfortunate anomaly, rather than a constitutive part of human existence. Social programs are seen as wasteful, recipients of social spending as burdens on the common good. Thus, in response to the question of how I hope the public and scholars working outside my community will make use of my contribution to religious ethics, I would say I hope it shows others that dependency is not an anomaly, that we enter the world dependent, that none of us would survive without receiving intensive care, and that we're obligated to help one another meet the demands of dependency. I want to inspire all of us to question the social organization of care and the distribution of responsibility for care. I want to counter the widespread exploitation of caregivers. Turning to the lessons I've taken from my colleagues on the panel, Mara begins her first chapter with the statement that to be a Jew is to be obligated, and with the idea that the constant, unceasing demands of child-rearing comprise a set of obligations that are ontologically prior to the mitzvot and even the model for them. I resonate deeply with this assertion that maternal experience is, among other things, an experience of obligation, and I find compelling her parallel to the Jewish experience of living under God's commandments. I also find the parallel she draws between God's relationship to Israel, as recounted in the Torah, and a mother's relationship with her child to be deeply evocative and theologically productive. After an extensive discussion of the ways in which maternal-child relationship shapes the subjectivity of the mother, Mara discusses parties outside of the dyad, she calls the third. Here she explores in particular paid caregivers and the neighbor, the many persons with whom our lives intersect each day in large and small ways, who influence the child, whose actions require a responsible parent, whose needs may exert a demand on parent and child. For example, she talks about standing with a child at the street corner and a stranger decides to walk against the light. And then you have to engage a conversation about why we don't walk against the light. And so this neighbor has sort of become a part of the parenting project. So, and I sometimes walk against the light. I found this discussion intriguing, but I do want to push discussions of justice beyond thirds and individual neighbors with whom we interact toward questions of political organization and distribution of resources. I think that the material aspects of caregiving demand this, as well as the history of exploitation in the social organization of care. I suggest that states might make payments to those caring for dependents. And when I say payments, I don't necessarily mean only cash payments. I mean government spending on health care, on child care, on preschool, those sorts of things. Drawing on the arguments of feminist economists about the economic value of caring labor, and noting that unpaid caregiving responsibilities lead many women into economic precarity, Michal's work reminds me that state support for families and for dependent care work will rarely be a straightforward, easy payment in recognition of our delightful labor, our socially valuable labor. State support can be problematic, too. Social reproduction is tied up in religious, cultural, and political values in many different ways and can be used by the state to promote these values. As Michal discusses, in Israel, family support policies are shaped by competing values. There is concern for the socioeconomic well-being of large families, usually the ultra-Orthodox families. However, such policies are largely motivated by demographic concerns. To outpace Arab demographic growth, to increase the number of young Israelis available for military service, and to respond to the losses in the Holocaust. Thus, when it became clear that family allowances and Israeli policy were primarily benefiting Arab Israeli families, Michal tells us, family allowances were eliminated. Advocates for state support of dependent care activities must remain vigilant about other agendas. In the United States, of course, the history of such policies is pervaded by racial dynamics. Politics necessarily involves structural asymmetries of power. While we may strive for greater equality and inclusion, and I draw on feminist political theorists to advocate for this, we must also always acknowledge that these asymmetries will exist. I would argue, as others have, that maternal experience can be a moral training ground for navigating such hierarchies, that politics requires an attunement to the needs of others, attentive listening, and prudential decisions about empowering or constraining the agency of others. I'm grateful to both Mara and Christy for their eloquent descriptions of this sort of attention and decision-making in the context of maternal practice. As they note, Parents must learn how to modulate their power, using it in ways that limit harm, facilitate human flourishing, and foster the agency of those who are more vulnerable or have less power. Those in positions of authority in other spheres of human life must do the same. Both Christy and Mara explore the complex task of fostering children's agency while keeping them reasonably safe, a task that requires, again, ongoing attention, attunement, to use Christy's term, restraint, and sometimes decisive action. I would argue that wisdom, listening, restraint, and sometimes authoritative intervention are often also necessary in the workplace, in politics, and in social structures. Maternal experience can form us in ways that have impact in these arenas of human social life. All three of my colleagues explore the ways in which power and agency are shaped and even enabled by constraints. Michal describes Haredi women invoking reproductive agency within gendered, privatized spaces that are allocated to them in a context where husbands, rabbis, and doctors hold great authority. As Mara notes, children have the power to go limp, to scream at the top of their lungs, to embarrass their parents. They have the power to make life difficult for adults. As they get older, they may learn how best to frame requests to get what they want. My teens are very good at this. These strategies are sometimes frustrating for caregivers, but we can also celebrate the creativity of our children's resistance as something that will serve them well in later years when seeking creative forms of agency in the face of power that may be more sinister than ours. The understanding that constraints are the crucible of agency and subjectivity also highlights some dangers. As Christy shows, for example, as a survival strategy, children may come to internalize the ends of an abusive caregiver as their own. One may wish that Haredi women could express agency in a broader arena than the private and gendered spaces assigned to them, and that they could express their agency more overtly. Maternal experience provides a peek into the exquisite challenge of our relations with one another, the ways in which we can and will go wrong, and our capacity to form but also maim the other, and to be formed or maimed. This glimpse into our capacities for good and for harm certainly stands as a resource and challenge to religious ethics.
Sandra Sullivan Dunbar of Loyola University Chicago. Now, last but not least, from this fascinating panel on maternal experience as a challenge and resource for religious ethics, here's Dr. Christy Traina of Northwestern University.
I'm very, very grateful to have been asked to stand back and reflect with these wonderful friends and colleagues about the places our work has been going and think about where mine might deserve a little push because of their wisdom. Do read these books if you haven't. Sandy's work in the careful, balanced, comprehensive mode of Margaret Farley, Michal's in the critical, edgy, but still stubbornly appreciative mode of Susan Martha Kahn, and Mara's gritty, poetic inhabiting of life and text in the mode of Wendy Farley. These are works that I will revisit and continue to absorb, and so you're just getting my first brush here. In particular, we all parse power, and that's my job this morning. Here are some of the features of power that I see now in our work, and leaning towards some questions at the end. First of all, and maybe most obviously, in our work, power asymmetry, we say, power asymmetry must essentially and will practically always be with us. As Mara and I have argued, white feminists of the 1970s and 1980s were about the project of celebrating mutual egalitarian power. Erotic power, creative, desiring, collaborative energy flowing between equals was the name of the game, and creating space for its free exercise was the white feminist solution to the problem of both interpersonal injustice and structural oppression. Sarah Lucia Hoagland lobbied for leveling the playing field by creating egalitarian lesbian women's communities.
Carter Hayward jettisoned boundaries in order to undo the mystique of authority that's bound up in the professions. Sarah Ruddick was under no illusion that parents and children were equals, but she often suggested that parenting toward equality was what excused parental uses of power over children that would otherwise be problematic. Black feminists, of course, were under no illusion that this could work, given persistent structural evil, probably why Audre Lorde defines erotic power a bit differently as arising within ourselves, orienting us kind of like a compass. Our work on reproduction and parenting also runs against this dream of making human de jure existential equality a de facto reality for additional reasons. First, inequality cannot, as you probably have figured out by now, and must not ever go away, both because childhood will never go away, and also because once we analyze all possible axes of inequality, every relationship is asymmetrical in some sense. Even power equality among adults is at best an eschatological aspiration. Sorry, that was very Christian. Okay. Second, and largely because of this fact, we will never stop eroticizing inequality. We will never stop being thrilled by power differences, both up and down the power gradient. So rather than eradicating power difference, feminism in our mode thinks with it. What does it mean to navigate constantly shifting relations between and among unequals ethically? All of this is especially true when children's dependency and vulnerability are at the center of relationships. Parents' relationships with offspring, teachers' relationships with students, priests' relationship with altar servers. Because of the developmental dimension that weights the effects of adult power heavily, and because they necessarily are intimate connections between particular people, and because of the kinds of obligations that they involve, which Mara and Sandy articulate so powerfully, these relationships are in so many ways different from relationships between unequal adults. Still, they keep the problem of inequality in general before us. The second place I think we all converge, and this is maybe you want to argue with me about this, and so maybe this is a question. I think we think Michel Foucault was right about something. I think we all de facto accept his 1982 essay, The Subject and Power, but we believe that it applies to the youngest of children. Power is not a substance. It exists only in relational dynamics between subjects, both paradoxically freely acting within the constraints they create for each other. I'll qualify that in a minute, as he does, because of the way that Sandy does. If there's no freedom, there's no power. What does it mean to take children as full, free subjects in this dynamic? It means, as Mara says, that not only do parents shape their children, but children likewise affect and shape their parents both physically and existentially, and usually unintentionally. And the extension of this to God and the effect of Israel on God is theologically very rich. It also means that action includes restraint or studied inaction, either to enlarge the safe or perilous spaces in which children realize themselves by acting. Here I'm speaking in particular to parents of teens. You may be familiar with enlarging their perilous spaces for them. Or to prevent our words or bodies from harming them in moments when we feel powerless. Or to insist that their needs and sometimes even their wants check our desires. I think we also, and this has been said many times this morning, I hope that there's an inflection here that will be new still, are concerned about the structural context of power relations. We agree with Foucault also that people in relation are not isolated as if in bubbles from the world around them. They function under the constraints of larger institutional and governmental, literally and figuratively, dynamics that they don't choose and that create and constrain fields of possible action. These include, for example, male Talmudic and rabbinic authorities in Michal's and Mara's work, whose gendered aporias create de jure places for women to exert their agency. As Michal argues, they also include the battles between usually male rabbis and doctors that create de facto space for women to throw up their hands and ignore all heteronomous authority, with both good and ill results measured by the criteria of Western obstetrical practice. On the one hand, Michal worries about these women's tendency implicitly to rate their own autonomy above their physical health and that of their unborn children. On the other hand, don't we do this all the time? Michal invites us to think much, much harder about the threshold between true moral freedom and a condescending my way or the highway paternalism for which Western obstetrics can stand in her book, or maybe maternalism in some cases, right? Governmentality is literally governmental. Michal won't let us forget the pronatalist legislation of the Israeli state, just as we must never forget the racist eugenic histories of United States policies and laws around reproduction. Nor will Sandy let us forget that liberal equality of male citizens established men as the legally unchallenged rulers of the domestic sphere. Gross power difference is not just theoretically interesting, especially when it is not benevolent, but even when it is, it herds many of us into cattle chutes where the freedom we do have may be limited to creatively assigning meaning to the positions the power difference allots us, the meaning of being in the cattle chute, and to slyly perhaps shaping and troubling those in power. A curious question about Mara's and Michal's work in contrast to Sandy's and mine. I don't want to overdraw this contrast, but there's a sense in which Mara and Michal explore what happens, what may occur when we accept or work within gendered Talmudic and rabbinic medical and cultural aporias as they are given to us, and then explore women's agency as embodied subjectivity within those spaces. Whereas Sandy and I tend to believe that we're called upon to choose between actively embracing the Vatican's gender distinctions, like the new feminists, or actively rejecting them as arbitrary and limiting, obviously the right choice, right? Maybe we can talk about our responses to official religious authority, which really is important in both of our traditions. I think the difference is also partly tied to method. For instance, ethnography and exploration of Talmudic commentary can give us de facto ethics, and theology tends to make us want to be idealistic in that masculine liberal mode, which that ties us up in some interesting gendered knots right there. Okay. But a challenge arises from these differences, I think, because we can navigate among three modes: honest explorations of women's agency as capacity for action, as Michal cites Mahmoud; critiques of situations that unjustly narrow capacities for action, Michal and Sandy both explore this; and distinctions between limits that are truly unjust and should be protested, and those that are simply unavoidably given and must be accepted. Mara addresses many of these. It won't surprise anybody here that I think moral luck is an interesting conceptual tool for these discussions, not because it gives us clean answers, because it doesn't, but because it gives us the language to parse the both and that emerges when we're being honest
about being confronted with complex institutional, cultural systems, persistent structural evil, persistent lack, immediate human need, and the impossibility of fulfilling all of our obligations at the end of the care line. We also need to be careful about how we speak about this, because highlighting women's agency in situations of oppression can play into neoliberal tendencies to label systemically constrained choices private lifestyle decisions, which I think we would all protest. Thanks so much, friends.
Thanks for listening to this fantastic panel featuring Mara Benjamin, Michal Rauscher, Sandra Sullivan Dunbar, and this last speaker, Christy Traina. If the popular and powerful voices of religion were more often more like these, it would be a better country and world. Ethics Forward comes to you every week on Tuesday at 6 p.m., Wednesday at 10 a.m., and Thursday at 8 a.m. on 106.5 FM Forward Radio in lovely downtown Louisville, Kentucky, and streams live at forwardradio.org. Forward Radio is people-powered community radio running on volunteer labor. If you want to help out or chip in, surf on over to forwardradio.org and see how you can get involved. If you ever miss an episode of Ethics Forward, you can find the entire SoundCloud archive at forwardradio.org/ethicsforward. The show also benefits from the music and production help of Prismic, who's also on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/prismicofficial. I'm also grateful to Maddie Claybo for her editing and production help, and to the U of L Philosophy Department, which makes her work possible. Ethics Forward will be back next week. Thanks for listening!